This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You want the big picture? Here it comes. I've picked two of my favorite power interviews from years of interviewing scientists, authors, and experts for you. You will hear a little-known professor from the University of Utah, Dr. Tim Garrett. He's a cloud specialist. But Garrett published a paper in America's most prestigious scientific journal after being championed by the father of global warming, Wally Broker. It still took 2 years to get out. Why? Because Garrett worked out that according to the laws of physics, only a complete collapse of civilization could save us now from devastating global warming. We'd rather keep on driving around than hear about that, I guess. Then we'll go back to one of my favorite climate scientists, Dr. Peter Ward. He's got the history of life on this planet in his back pocket. Some of the long-term future, too. Peter Ward says nature isn't nice, and really, there isn't much of a plan. We can dream of an intelligent Gaian god already in command of the future to be. But the biological record, says Ward, is more like Mr. Bean is in charge. We need to get a grip on who we really are and where we really are. Last week, I ran clips from the former U.S. Treasury secretaries who say climate change will ruin any future economy. It was one of the most important stories so far this year. Now, we had some problems with the Radio EcoShock server, so if you missed the Crashing Climate News show, be sure to grab it from our SoundCloud page. We just passed 5,000 listens on SoundCloud. Not too bad for a startup a couple of months old. Thank you for tuning in there. So let's get to it. Here's Professor Tim Garrett with one of Radio EcoShock's greatest hits. Maybe energy conservation isn't enough. What if global warming is already an unstoppable force? Is economic collapse one of our only hopes? These disturbing questions arise in a controversial study by Tim Garrett, an associate professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Utah. Tim, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
Hi. Well, can you give us the title of your new paper and where people can find it?
The title of the paper is, Are There Basic Physical Constraints on Carbon Dioxide Emissions? And the article can be found on my website, perhaps most easily, which is easily found by either Googling Tim Garrett or going to the Atmospheric Sciences page at the University of Utah, or it can be found through the journal Climatic Change.
Okay, and I'll toss in a link to your webpage in my blog for this program. Well, look, I understand you applied some basic physics to the way our civilization works. Can you explain your theory for us?
Sure. I think the concept is easily understood in the light of perhaps looking at a growing child. And this is a familiar analogy, perhaps a good place to start, because if we think about a growing child, child consumes energy, as does an adult, in order to maintain daily operations of that child. But what is a bit different with a child is that as the child uses the energy, it uses energy not only to maintain its current size, but also uses some fraction of that energy in order to grow its current size. And if it does that efficiently, then it is able to grow faster and thereby consume more energy rather than less energy in the future. And it's a very simple physical concept. It can be written down with basic thermodynamic arguments using equations. But as I showed, it can also be applied to civilization as a whole, treating civilization as being an energy-consuming organism. And if that is done, then it turns out that there is a very simple relationship between the rate of energy consumption by civilization as a whole and its economic value. It turns out that money is power, where power is the rate of energy consumption. There is a simple relationship of about 10 milliwatts per inflation-adjusted $1990 dollar. And that's really the key result, I think, that leads to the other results that I found in the paper.
And one of those was a suggestion that alternative energy like solar may not actually help stop climate change. And I've heard those doubts from other scientists and from an economist like Britain's Tim Jackson. So growth, even green technology, could just mean more energy is consumed. Is that right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the green technology, I think, is a slightly separate issue from the growth itself. The society will consume energy and probably try to maximize its growth regardless, whether it's green technology or not green technology. Perhaps the difference between green technologies and other types is that some of these green technologies aren't associated with carbon dioxide emissions. But as I pointed out, in order just to stabilize carbon dioxide emissions, the switch to non-CO2 emitting power sources would have to be very rapid, about 2.2% per year. So that works out to, just as an easy metric, one nuclear power plant per day.
Wow. Well, I don't think we're about to build a nuclear power plant per day, so we'll get in just a few minutes, I think, to what the other alternative could be. But I wanted first to raise the question, to everyone's surprise, you've said that we don't even need to calculate population growth or even the spread of higher living standard to know how things will go, that this energy is the key factor. That seems a bit hard to believe.
Yeah, it might seem hard to believe, but I mean, it's not that standard of living and population aren't part of the energy consumption by civilization. Obviously, people consume energy in commensurate to their standard of living. But the point is that our standard of living and how many people there are on the planet is really just a consequence of past energy efficiency. So to think about it another way, coming back to the growing child, I don't need to think about the cells, the number of cells in the child, or how much energy each cell consumes to know that the child will grow. And I can look at how much energy the child is consuming to get an idea of how fast the child will continue to grow. I don't need to know the details.
You've also described civilization as a heat engine. Could you enlarge on that?
Well, I think that's the basic idea. A heat engine is, well, it's a very familiar concept in thermodynamics or in physics. Everyone learns about it in their physics degree, if that's the path they take. And normally, a heat engine was, well, the idea was first coined in the 1800s when people were thinking about digging up coal or whatever it was. And you pop coal into an engine, and then it would do mechanical work to lift something or move something. In the case of civilization, we aren't trying to lift some external object. When we consume energy, we consume energy to do work for ourselves. So it's a slightly different heat engine than is a normal conception. Here there's a feedback loop. If we consume energy and do work with that energy, that work is done to enable us to consume more energy in the future. So there's a feedback that leads to growth in this situation, rather than just simply work being done on some external agency.
And meanwhile, our politicians continue to call us back to a growing GDP. That sounds like our carbon emissions will never really go down if that happens.
Well, in fact, if it's a growing GDP, that not only corresponds to accelerating growth of carbon dioxide emissions, but actually an interesting mathematical form, which is super exponential growth. So it's not just exponential growth, but it is the exponent of an exponent. So emissions are not only accelerating, but the rate of growth is accelerating as well. And that's just an unavoidable consequence of a growing GDP.
And that's pretty believable when we hear about what's happening in China and India and all around the world.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's always a constant surprise. You see reports where the people who are measuring the CO2 are constantly surprised that CO2 emissions rates have continued to accelerate even when the scientists are hearing dire economic forecasts.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with scientist Tim Garrett from the University of Utah. And we're about to explore whether economic collapse is the best way to save the biosphere, because we've talked about nuclear power. We need a new atomic plant every day, and that doesn't seem likely in time to avert catastrophic climate disruption, in my opinion. So that leaves economic collapse, and some deep greens, as you know, Tim, have called for this, but you're among the first academics that I know of to publish a peer-reviewed paper saying collapse may be necessary to save a habitable planet. Or am I putting words in your mouth? Maybe you didn't say quite that.
Well, not quite that, but that's what I did say is that if we are to ever stabilize emissions, that necessitates rather unpalatable, let's say, economic implications. If we are just to stabilize emissions, and I think this is a bit counterintuitive at first, but if we were just to stabilize the emissions, not so that they're decreasing, but just to stabilize them, the economy would have to be zero, adjusted for inflation. That does not mean that there wouldn't be economic activities going on, simply that none of these economic activities would add to the value of civilization. They would always be compensated for by some inflationary pressure. Now, I don't know what that world would look like. I've never lived in a world like that, but perhaps we can imagine by looking at some recent situations in places like Zimbabwe, where they ended up with hyperinflation, and it was a very different sort of life than we are used to ourselves in North America.
And so you looked at past development of civilization and applied your formula. Can you take the same formula and try and measure out how deep and how bad this collapse would have to be? I guess you've sort of expressed it right now, but could you enlarge on that, on what it would take to bring our carbon back to, say, 350? Can we figure that out?
Wow, I did run this once, and with some extremely drastic scenarios, I was able to see the model settle out at about 450 parts per million. But that would mean virtual complete economic collapse within my lifetime. I cannot imagine how it would be possible to get down to 350 parts per million. It seems implausible.
I gather it was hard to get this paper published until it came out in late 2009. What has been the reaction so far?
Well, the reaction I've got has been, there's been a fair bit of interest from people, interestingly enough, who are proponents of the peak oil theory. So for the peak oil fans, of course, finding some sort of basic link between the economy and rates of energy consumption is a very useful thing, because then they can relate it to their own understanding of the size and depletion rates of geological reservoirs of oil. Oh, that's heartening. I mean, it's nice to have when someone's interested in it. And other colleagues have found some interest, too, in just the basic thermodynamic framework. I think a lot of people have long had a suspicion that statements that increasing energy efficiency will lead to reduced energy consumption something's quite obviously wrong with that, because it runs counter to our experience. We've been increasing energy efficiency throughout history. And
yes, you mentioned Jevons' Law, I believe it was.
Yeah, Jevons' paradox, that's it. Yeah, I mean, Jevons was an interesting guy. He was extremely insightful, I think a bit too serious for his own good. He died at a year early age, I think, because he stressed himself out worrying about things. But yeah, he had this very insightful comment about the introduction of the steam engine, James Watt's steam engine, in the late 1800s. And he was saying this was, you know, a major efficiency gain, and it led to increased coal consumption rather than less coal consumption. And he made a very emphatic argument that any argument to the contrary was completely wrong.
And as I learned from your website, your real specialty is clouds. And listeners, you can find that link, as I say, to Tim Garrett's website and the Radio EcoShock blog. In my opinion, Tim, clouds are one of the last great frontiers of unknown science. Do you foresee a time when humans could control the clouds? And if so, should we?
There's actually a history to trying to control clouds, and even today people try to engage in something called cloud seeding, where they try to add silver iodide pellets to clouds in the attempt to accelerate their production of rain. Of course, this has agricultural benefits, and actually the field started with out of military interest. And it's been largely discredited simply because the amount of energy in a cloud is immense. It's something like many nuclear bombs going off at once. It's a huge amount of energy. You could power all of civilization if you could harness the energy off a few big clouds. So to imagine that we can control clouds seems a bit fanciful to me. And I know there are people who talk about it, but I'm highly skeptical.
Well, some have mentioned it as a form of geoengineering, as an alternative way to control the heat that reaches the Earth, but you don't really see a future for that in the near term.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my research is based on the ideas that these people are proposing, which are that if we add aerosol to clouds, then that will make them brighter and reflect more sunlight. And my belief is that we may make the cloud brighter here, but that would necessitate things becoming darker somewhere else, and that it would all be a wash once you consider the planet as a whole.
You know, Tim, I'm personally very resistant to recommending collapse as a solution. Billions of people would be hurt, and likely many would die, and I'm enjoying our civilization, including talking to you right now long distance. So how do you personally handle the ugly possibility that we may be at peak wealth right now with a downhill ride ahead of us?
Yeah, well, I've two young children, so it's on my mind. We're along for the ride, and we will see what happens. And in the meantime, I guess I figure enjoy life while we can.
What are you working on now, and what would you like to research in the future?
Well, right now I'm about to submit a paper on how the Arctic becomes polluted and how clouds remove pollution from the Arctic. But I would like to pursue more of this research on the thermodynamics of complex systems. I've applied this to all of civilization, and right now I would like to use the same sort of framework to understand the development, growth, and death of clouds. I think the same principles can be applied, whether it's to civilization, to clouds, to a child, or whatever it is. We all live and die by the first and second laws of thermodynamics, so these principles should be quite general.
It might be interesting to apply it to cities as well, since most of us are living in cities and there are huge thermodynamic flows happening in cities themselves.
That hasn't been done quite from a thermodynamic standpoint, but it has been from a mathematical standpoint. And in fact, when I mentioned earlier the concept of super-exponential growth, there has been a recent paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy, well, I guess it's 2 or 3 years old now, that highlighted super-exponential growth being one of the defining characteristics of successful cities.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Dr. Tim Garrett from the University of Utah. Find this interview as a free MP3 download at our website, ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for being with us. You are listening to the best of Radio EcoShock as I put out the key interviews from years of chasing down the truth about the truth. Stay tuned for more. Hello, I'm Alex Smith with a serious question for you. What if the past determines our future? Are we humans headed for success or lasting economic depression, perhaps on an overheated planet? Dr. Timothy Garrett is Associate Professor of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Utah. In February 2010, Tim joined us on Radio EcoShock to discuss his disturbing new scientific paper. It outlined a direct relationship between the energy we burn, the wealth we create, and the growth of greenhouse gas emissions. Now he's gone a step further with some new work. So, Dr. Tim Garrett, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
I think we should start with your original formula for energy and wealth. Can you take a shot at explaining that for the intelligent listener?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it really started just as a simple query as to where the economic value comes from. And, you know, coming from a physics background and being really totally naive in economics, I thought, well, maybe it has something to do with the rate of energy consumption by civilization. In other words, perhaps that our wealth, the wealth of civilization, has a direct link to how much energy we can consume. To me, that seemed like a reasonable assumption, because in order for us to do anything, which I suppose is perhaps a measure of our wealth, we need to consume energy. That's a basic law of the physical universe. It is through energy transformations that anything happens. And so what I tried to do was just simply look at this using some available data. And it turned out that this relationship is, in fact, fixed, that there is a constant relationship of about 10 milliwatts that is required to support every inflation-adjusted $1990 of economic value. And that was the core result of the first paper I did into this. And what I tried to do is go from there to see what this implied for subjects such as global warming, which are closer to my primary field of research in atmospheric sciences.
Well, based on everything we know so far, if we grow the economy, as every politician promises, we'll put more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. But what if the economy crashes? Will we put less up there, or will we reach safe levels if we have a severe downturn?
Well, this is where my work differed slightly from perhaps what other people are thinking. Now, the way I define wealth is that it is the accumulation of our past production of economic value. So what we have today is an accumulation of what we've been able to do in the past. Now, when you talk about the economy declining, well, usually what people think about is they think about GDP going down, the gross world product declining with time. And what I showed was that if the GDP declines with time, which is ordinarily what we would think of as being a depression, this would not, in fact, correspond to lower carbon dioxide emissions. In fact, carbon dioxide emissions would need to grow. Instead, in order for carbon dioxide emissions to go down, what would be required is effectively a complete collapse of the economy. A collapse in the sense that the gross world product would have to be almost completely offset by inflation. So that, in some sense, it would seem strange to an economist to think about this, but in some sense, the global product would have to be negative rather than positive. In other words, we'd have to be in a situation of net consumption rather than net production. We are consuming more of what we've produced in the past rather than producing new, increasing wealth. So that's a rather extreme situation, but this is what the data bears out as being required to have lower carbon dioxide emissions.
So if I understand it correctly, your definition of wealth does not include the sort of fantasy money that, like the quantitative easing from the U.S. Federal Reserve, but it includes everything that humans have produced that's still here from the beginning of time. I mean, even the Pantheon in Rome would be part of our accumulated wealth at this point.
Yes. Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, I part of my wealth is my house, but the house was produced back in 1926.
And you have a new paper submitted to the journal Climatic Change, and the title is On the Coupled Evolution of Inflation, Wealth, and Atmospheric Concentrations of Carbon Dioxide. And you do go a step further here, predicting, it seems to me, almost the worst of all worlds, high levels of greenhouse gases and inflation. I still don't really get what inflation has to do with climate change.
I was actually just down in New Orleans for a scientific meeting, and I spent some time after that with my family. And we went to some local museums, and of course in New Orleans, you know, there's the lasting legacy of the Hurricane Katrina disaster. And with Katrina, as it was with, you know, perhaps all natural disasters are, historically, they've been inflationary. What they do is they destroy past production while people perhaps still have the dollars in their pockets, but there are fewer things available for their dollars to be matched to. So the cost of what is present, as it goes up in cost. Now, this wasn't actually how I approached it in the paper, but I think this was how an economist would normally approach the topic. The way I approached it in the paper was that I showed that environmental destruction, whether it's by disease or by weather or whatever it is effectively a decay on our past production that devalues what we have, and that is effectively an inflationary pressure. Now, what you can think about global warming being is, in some sense, it's like a long-term natural disaster. It is not only a long-term natural disaster that happens continuously, unlike Katrina, which was momentarily, but it also happens globally. So with Katrina, it was instantaneous, effectively instantaneous, and they caused a short-term inflation. But then people were able to come in from outside and provide new resources that stabilized
the New Orleans economy. Now, I was in New Orleans, things were expensive still, but, you know, it wasn't out of this world. But in a future world, you can imagine, now, this is slightly speculative, but it's consistent with what you would expect from the physics. You could imagine that there is an ever-increasing environmental pressure on civilization that continually acts as an ever-stronger force that eats away at what we have produced in the past. And this will be an inflationary pressure that cannot be supplanted by outside resources from outside, because it is acting globally. It will be affecting everybody.
Right. If we have rising seas, for example, eating up some of our best farmland or salinating it, there's just, you can't make some more land like that. It's gone.
Exactly.
So that pushes up the price of all the remaining land, and that's how climate change can create inflation, for example.
Yes.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Timothy Garrett, an atmospheric scientist from the University of Utah. And I'd like to really get to the conclusions of your new paper. Based on our past records of energy use and wealth, what does your model show as possible futures?
Well, in fact, I mean, this was actually stimulated by our past conversation. In my first study, I showed that carbon dioxide emissions and wealth were intrinsically coupled. Without actually decarbonizing the economy, like switching to renewables or nuclear power at an extraordinarily fast rate, you cannot have wealth without having carbon dioxide emissions. The two go together. And in fact, since 1970, the relationship between the two has been very, very tightly fixed. Now, that would seem to have implications for the future because carbon dioxide emissions accumulate in the atmosphere. As carbon dioxide emissions accumulate in the atmosphere, some fraction goes into what we call sinks in the oceans and the land, but about half of what we emit accumulates in the atmosphere. That is going to create an ever-increasing pressure on civilization. Now, by eating away at civilization wealth, global warming will actually reduce our capacity to emit carbon dioxide. So there's actually what you would call in physics a negative feedback. So our wealth is emitting CO2. CO2 accumulates in the atmosphere and then feeds back on our capacity to produce new wealth. Eventually, one could imagine that civilization would enter into a phase of collapse because the carbon dioxide levels are so high that we're simply unable to produce new goods without them being destroyed by global warming. And at that point, perhaps emissions would go down. And eventually, if civilization collapsed fast enough, then perhaps carbon dioxide concentrations would be stabilized. Now, you asked me last time what would be required to keep carbon dioxide concentrations at 450 parts per million. And that's normally what's considered to be about a dangerous level by, let's say, during the Copenhagen Accord. And I made a guess that it would require actually flat-out civilization collapse, and based on some preliminary work I did. And then I decided to look into this a bit more deeply, and I actually wrote a second paper where it turns out that is true. Not only would we have to have civilization collapse starting very, very soon, like within the next decade or so, but we would also have to have extremely rapid decarbonization in order to keep carbon dioxide levels below, let's say, 500 parts per million, twice pre-industrial levels. In order to keep them below 1,000, well, without civilization collapse, let's say we have continuing health, let's say that the civilization is very resilient to global warming, then carbon dioxide levels are going to go extremely high by the end of the century, probably above 1,000 parts per million. If you think about 1,000 parts per million, well, that's probably, depends on what the climate sensitivity is, but that's something along the lines of 5 degrees Celsius warming at least. And when we think of 5 degrees Celsius warming, people are familiar with this, usually start bringing up highly catastrophic scenarios. So in some sense, it's hard to imagine how civilization cannot be in pretty dire straits during this century.
Well, I hear people suggesting that we could make a big cut in carbon emissions just with energy efficiency. We'll all get electric cars and we'll put in the light bulbs. And I've heard that you don't think so much about energy efficiency as a way to save ourselves.
Well, actually, it's almost counterintuitive. But no, in fact, it's the other way around. The whole reason that civilization has been so successful and has grown so quickly is that we are energy efficient. It is our efficiency of taking material goods and energy and converting them into production and net growth that actually leads to us producing carbon dioxide. The increasingly efficient we become, the more efficient we become at growing civilization and its wealth. I think this is actually common sense. I mean, we always strive for efficiency because we have some underlying sense that efficiency is good for our general well-being. But our general well-being is normally measured in terms of economic wealth. And as I showed, economic wealth has a direct correspondence to carbon dioxide emissions. So increasing energy efficiency leads to more energy consumption, and more energy consumption leads to more carbon dioxide emissions. And I'm not the first person to say this. This has actually been pointed out by energy economists ever since the late 1800s. So I'm not sure why it's not more generally accepted today.
You know, the study of economy has been called the dismal science, and your paper might qualify for that title. The abstract reads, "There are no plausible thermodynamically supported solutions that avoid inflation rates less than 100% and lead to stabilized atmospheric CO2 concentrations within this century." To me, that says we either get worthless money or a dangerous atmosphere or both. Are these our choices?
I don't see any other options. I mean, I suppose what you could argue is that civilization could decarbonize, switch to renewables and nuclear power at such an extraordinarily fast rate that in some sense we decouple ourselves from the atmosphere. So in other words, we are able to keep consuming energy without affecting atmospheric composition. But even there, there's actually, I mean, in some sense it's rather amusing. Well, it's intellectually amusing at least, that decarbonizing civilization will actually not be as effective as one might expect. Now, decarbonizing civilization, let's say we were to do this proactively, presumably it would cost money, and we would only do it with the expectation that it would help alleviate the worst damages of global warming. And I think that makes sense. You know, why would we do it otherwise? We would put in the effort because it will benefit us in the long run. But remember, anything that benefits us in the long run is effectively measurable as an increase in our wealth. And an increase in our wealth will translate to an increase in energy consumption. So, in essence, what happens is decarbonizing promotes our wealth and our energy consumption in the future. But increasing our energy consumption, as long as we are partly a fossil fuel economy, will correspond to increasing fossil fuel carbon dioxide emissions. So this doesn't completely offset the decarbonization gains, but because it promotes society health, we actually do not gain as much from decarbonizing as one might initially expect, because it's a dynamic system and we would actually continue to grow faster than we would otherwise.
I can see it. I mean, if we build a lot of nuclear power plants, it's going to take some carbon shovels to get all that cement going, and all the materials still have to be brought out. We're going to use oil to do it. And so there might actually be a burst of new emissions just trying to do that.
Well, yeah, there's that too, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, recently I recorded a speech by the former Whole Earth catalog guru, Stuart Brand. He calls for an all-out effort to geoengineer the planet to stave off a climate disaster. He likes the idea of making clouds brighter by shooting seawater into them. That's supposed to reflect more sunlight, hoping to cool the Earth. You are a scientist with expertise in clouds. What do you think about that?
I'm quite skeptical that that would work. I mean, geoengineering is, in some sense, it may be a question not whether we should do it, but perhaps when we will do it. Because one could imagine that civilization will always try to do whatever it can to optimize its capacity to grow. But with regards to brightening clouds, well, that's been suggested as perhaps a viable way of doing it. One popular way that's been suggested is to produce lots of sea spray from some fancy ships. This sea spray goes up into the clouds, and that makes them brighter because if there are lots of small aerosol particles, these sea salt particles, then there will be more droplets in the clouds and also smaller droplets. And that has two effects. One is that, for some reasons I won't describe, it makes the clouds brighter. Just by having a large number of small droplets, you have brighter clouds than clouds that have a small number of large droplets. But it also tends to shut off precipitation in the clouds. And because precipitation is a sink, it's a means for losing water from clouds, it has been argued that the clouds will have longer lifetimes and therefore reflect more sunlight to space for a longer period of time, and because they're brighter, they'll reflect more. These ideas have been around since the 1970s and 1980s, and it has since become apparent to a lot of researchers in this area that the effect is not nearly as strong as one might initially expect. There are all sorts of, again, negative feedbacks, and these negative feedbacks often act to entirely erase the brightening effect that you might expect from these aerosols going into the clouds. I mean, just to give one example, the clouds that would be targeted are these large sheets of stratus clouds that and stratocumulus clouds that are off the western coasts of continents. So where you are, I guess you're in Vancouver, are you? You're probably very familiar with low-level clouds. I used to live in Seattle, and it was, you know, in Seattle, it's the entire winter was covered with this large deck of low-level clouds. Now, these clouds, if we brighten them, then they tend to be over the ocean. If we brighten them, then less solar radiation comes in to heat up the surface. And it is warming of the surface that enables the fluxes of moisture and heat from the oceans and the surface upwards into the atmosphere that enable the clouds to form in the first place. So let's say the clouds become brighter, they cool the surface, then there's less flux of heat and moisture to form the clouds, and then the clouds dissipate. So it could be that adding aerosols to clouds does not make them brighter and more long-lived, but actually shorter-lived and darker.
You know, you're kind of a troublemaker in a way here. Because we've got a lot of people who are looking for a realistic way out of this awful dilemma, and you've got a really sharp mind that seems to be you can stick some pins in the balloon and away it goes. But I guess that really is what science is about. I mean, we're looking for what is real and what works and what doesn't.
Well, of course. I mean, you know, these are interesting physics problems. And I mean, one of the privileges of, you know, being a university scientist is, of course, that, I don't know, you get to think about these problems for the simple joy of thinking about them. And if the answers end up one way or rather than the other, well, that's, well, so be it. I mean, it's the joys in trying to figure something out. Yeah, I mean, that's for me, that was the fun of doing the economics problem. I mean, I have no background in economics, but I am as much a player as anybody else in the economic system, and wouldn't it be fun if it is possible to understand the economic system using the tools that, well, I, as a physicist, understand from my research in doing clouds.
Thank you so much for sharing your time with us, Tim.
Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. For the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Peter Ward, paleontologist and professor of biology, as well as earth and space sciences at the University of Washington in Seattle. Peter last joined us on our December 9th, 2008 program for a discussion of his book, Under a Green Sky. Now he's back with a new idea, sure to rattle a lot of people. It's called the Medea Hypothesis. Peter Ward, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
And thanks so much for having me again.
Well, your new book picks a fight with a beloved scientist, Sir James Lovelock. Can you explain Lovelock's Gaia Hypothesis, and then we'll get to your answer to it?
Yeah, the Gaia Hypothesis is really a wonderfully introspective, I would say, from both a mental and a psychological point of view, hypothesis about how the world works and how nature works. And introspective in the sense that it has, by itself, entirely spawned what we call New Age or New World religions. It really has a sense that the Earth is alive, and or the Earth and its systems act in such a way to better or optimize the planet for life itself.
And I gather that it's now split up into two versions that you take on in your book.
Yeah, there's always been an extreme fringe, and Lovelock himself is really one of the amazing intellects of the 20th century, although for a variety of reasons, I think some of his 21st century ideas are getting increasingly batty, and I'll go into these in a minute. But it also split off into the whole New Age business, which he never advocated. And the most extreme view of Gaia is that the Earth itself, including all the hard stuff that most of the Earth is made up of, is part of a living being, that we are one gigantic living planet with this thin veneer of gas and life itself over this much thicker, rocky planet, but the whole thing's alive. And that not even Lovelock himself really advocates that, although in the past he's dabbled in that. The other is that there are many systems equivalent to, say, our organ systems or our blood system, which maintain life, and that through time the whole makes it better for the individual.
And I guess that even that branch has split into that which optimizes the planet for life and that which merely regulates the planet somehow using biological means so that life can continue.
Yeah, that's really, you've hit it beautifully, actually. That really is the division that goes on. How much is optimization? How much is just letting life continue? I don't think anyone argues with the fact that life influences the planet. It influences geology. It influences the gas of the atmosphere. It has all of these effects on the physical world, and that obviously vice versa, the physical world has effects on biology. That's almost the weakest kind of Gaia hypothesis, is that there is this interaction. No one disputes that. On the other hand, the sense that life itself is making the world better for future life is the other aspect, and that's really where James Lovelock is. It's kind of like you buy a house and or rent a hotel room, if you will, and then while you're there in that hotel, you paint it and clean it up and put in new furniture and spend all this money on it so that the next guest has even a better hotel room. I mean, that's not really what a lot of us think that life is doing here.
So by contrast to that, what is the Medea hypothesis?
Well, Medea is the worst Greek mother, because Gaia is the name that Lovelock came up with for the good mother, and it was the Greek idea of good mother Earth. And I just almost tongue-in-cheek, but not too much, came up with this idea of Medea. And from Greek literature, we know of Jason and the Golden Fleece. He ran off with King Aetes, who had stolen the fleece, his daughter Medea, married Medea, and Jason, it turns out, was a pretty good captain and a really bad husband. And Medea, in a fit of pique, murdered their children several years later when Jason found himself flirting with other queens. So if you want a bad mother, Medea is probably about the worst. And the sense is not so tongue-in-cheek. Because of the mass extinctions and other episodes in Earth history, Mother Earth has murdered her children over and over and over again.
And I remember in your book, Under a Green Sky, you came to this chunk of rock that looked like about, if I remember correctly, about 10 million years, where there was practically not much alive left in the fossil record, at least. That must be very startling to look at.
Oh, absolutely. And those were the seeds that brought Medea, at least in my own mind, to life, is when you look at these long intervals of time after mass extinction, it sure doesn't look like life has been optimizing the planet for much of anything. We really go back to a microbial world, and we have a sense that it's not getting better, it's just getting worse. And when life does come back, it's different life. I mean, you can't say better, you can't say worse, but you can certainly say different.
One of the great things about this book, in my opinion, is your ability to summarize and teach us the latest cutting-edge Earth science. There have been some really remarkable discoveries just in the last couple of years. I'd like to get into some of that brain food. But could you start by explaining what you see as a possible flaw in evolution that could end up wrecking our living planet?
Well, it's funny you say that. It was one of the first lectures I gave about this. I gave a trial tune-up to my department, which is composed of a lot of really good biologists, and one of the best, a man named Joe Felsenstein, who's a National Academy member evolutionist, sort of raised his hand up and said, well, you know, after you've given this presentation and knowing what I know about life, you're giving way too much chops to this Medea. I think evolution is really kind of a dumb tinkerer, and it kind of blunders from place to place, and he suggested that I call it not the Medea hypothesis, but the Mr. Bean hypothesis, that evolution is just this dumb blunderer, and that actually might be a much better sense of what happens, is that there are these evolutionary breakthroughs, and sometimes they're better for the species, more often they're worse, but quite often they have an effect on the entire ecosystem. A new species doesn't care what it does to anything else. It just wants to reproduce, make more of itself. We talk about the selfish gene. Well, I think we really need to talk about the selfish species.
I guess we're a prime example, but also some of the bacteria would take over if they could.
Absolutely, and they've been here before. They will be here again. There is a certain finite, a definite finite limit to the age of animals, just that is dictated by the nature of our enlarging sun, by the nature of an aging Earth. Everything's finite. Well, so too is the age of animals, and the bacteria are laying in wait to take back the planet that advanced animal life took from them 500 billion years ago.
I'd also like to imagine a mass extinction caused by a greenhouse effect. I don't think the public has any idea of what that might be like. Can you give us some clues of what happened?
Yeah, when I wrote Under a Green Sky, I tried to put out some op-ed pieces or something about this, and I was sort of viewed as a fringe lunatic, and that, although that may definitely still be the case, finally, actually, some people are waking up because of a whole raft of independent studies, both from the past mass extinctions, but what is happening on our planet today. I mean, I suggest that a greenhouse extinction just occurs when the planet warms up enough that the poles and the tropics are so similar in temperature that it slows down ocean currents. Slowing ocean currents causes the ocean to lose its oxygen. An oxygen-free ocean spawns a group of bacteria that animals don't like. In fact, these bacteria can kill off animals. Well, we're starting to see that right now. We have a warming poles, and the poles are warming radically faster than the tropics. Tropics just can't warm much warmer. The poles can warm up all the way to the temperature of the tropics. And so you have this asymmetry. The asymmetry is causing the heat difference between the polar regions and the equator to drop, and as that drops, there's less impetus for wind and current. As things stagnate, oxygen stops being pumped into the ocean. And there you go. So NASA got hold of this. A bunch of us were taken down to NASA Ames at the behest of the director there, saying, look, is this a bunch of nonsense or is it possible? And 15 scientists were invited, and every one of them stood up and said, you know, this is looking pretty bad. In fact, it's looking like it could happen way faster than anybody's suggesting, including a slowdown to the point of near cessation of the Pacific gyres starting next century. So it's definitely happening.
Well, I thought about you and your theory when I was listening to a lecture, one of the lectures at the Oxford Beyond 4 Degrees Climate Conference that was just held at the end of September, and Professor John Schellnhuber was talking about oxygen-free zones that were developing in the Indian Oceans at key levels where fish would live, and I thought, whoa, I wonder if that's the beginning of this.
It absolutely is. I mean, that conference scared everybody because simply the fact that there would be 4 degrees, and that's 4 degrees centigrade, by 2060, it has to be such a wake-up call, and yet the United States right now is so tied up in blocking health care, there's no conversation about a far more important bill in my mind, which is the climate bill, the climate change bills. Those things are just stalled. And we really are facing some very bad times, not for us. I mean, everybody who hears this program, we're fine. Our children and their children and their children are not going to be fine.
We're talking with Peter Ward about his book, The Medea Hypothesis. Peter, in this work, you also gave me my first image of the natural future of this planet and the time limit that all life lives under. How long have we got, Doc?
500 million years. I was at a science fiction convention where one of the science fiction writers looked at me and said, you've got to be kidding. And I said, why? She said, well, Why would anybody care about a 500 million years from now? And my thought was, well, look, you know, there's no reason that species have to go extinct. We don't have a gene in us that says you're going to go extinct in 2 million years. That doesn't happen. We have that aging gene that kills us, but species don't. We have bacteria on this planet that have not changed, as far as we can tell, in 3.5 billion years. And there's no reason that we as humans couldn't stay and engineer this planet until the ultimate end of Earth is going to be in 7 or 8 billion years when the sun goes red giant. But we've got billions of years if we keep our wits about us, literally.
Well, I could buy that in the long run, but I have to tell you, I'm a little worried about the call for geoengineering in the short run. Some of the right-wing think tanks and even the oil companies are getting on board with geoengineering as a way to bypass carbon controls and the Copenhagen Treaty. So and should we really turn the earth over to the people who can't run an economy or even a train system? It worries me a bit.
Well, that worries me a lot, but let's expand the sense of geoengineering and say that planting a tree is one of the most profound and efficient methods of geoengineering. What we're talking about is changing the natural order out of what, say, Mother Nature would have produced at this moment and amplifying. I think, again, we need to regulate and we need to control our atmosphere. We need to. If I had one button that I could make that everybody on Earth ought to have, it would be save the ice sheets. I mean, nothing else. Save the ice sheets. Because as go the ice sheets, goes human civilization. If we melt any further of our Antarctic and our Greenland ice sheets, and not ice caps, anything floating on the ocean is sea level neutral, but melting the continental ice sheets causes sea level to rise or fall or rise or fall. And look, the near-term problem is we're about to head to 9 billion people. If we raise sea level even 2 meters, we've reduced an enormous amount of agriculture. So you have the intersection of 9 billion people with, say, one quarter reduction in food somewhere in the next 50 to 100 years. And that's disaster. That is total disaster. And that's really the greatest single challenge facing us is the short-term sea level rise, agriculture, and too many mouths to feed.
And the biological level, another strange idea for me in your book is that we may not be living in the great age of plant and animal life, but rather in a declining old age of life on this planet. How did I get the idea from so many scientists that we were right now at the peak, the great green golden age of life?
It's funny how all these preconceived notions just go by the wayside. When I was raised in my first classes, I always read, even as a boy, that the way evolution worked is first there were fish, and then fish gave rise to amphibians, and we had the great age of amphibians, and we had the age of reptiles, and then an age of mammals. And yet the fossil record tells us that the age of mammals, the first great age of mammals, preceded the dinosaurs. The mammal-like reptiles, the first true mammals of the late Permian age, were wiped out by a greenhouse extinction. Dinosaurs were just a big mistake. There should have never been this age of dinosaurs but for this very nasty, volcanically produced, very anti-Gaian, very pro-Medean greenhouse extinction that ended the Permian.
Just getting back to the hypothesis, how do you judge things to be Medean versus Gaian, just so our listeners can tune into that idea?
Well, again, the whole Medean scheme of things is that life blunders around, and that there's really no, say, planning, there's no sense of optimizing, there's no plan, if you will. Optimization indicates there's a plan somewhere, that somehow things are naturally or unnaturally running according to some plan. Well, there's no planning. I mean, evolution is just this dumb tinkerer sort of bouncing around. Things that work well do well for a while until natural changes of the planet and the system makes other things do well. But this sense that there's optimization taking place, I think, is ridiculous. And what it does, it's like a false crutch. And this is where I just am getting on the case of Dr. Lovelock, is that he has this sense now that Gaia will take care of all the human problems. He used to say that it would be by wiping out the humans, and he keeps going back to that. I personally think we're pretty much extinction-proof. I think the technology is going to make us essentially immune to most of the things that kill most species. Now, it doesn't say extinction-proof means happy. It doesn't mean that we're going to have rich lives. It just might mean that our species goes on for a very long time. But Dr. Lovelock in Seattle was on radio saying the most unbelievable things, saying that right now China is buying up Africa because in the next 20 to 30 years, China will transfer all its population to Africa. Now, he said this publicly on the radio and then in front of a crowd. Now, he's right in saying that climate change is a big problem, but when you say that China is about to colonize Africa with a straight face, I mean, you lose a whole lot of credibility. So anyway, it just seems I'm raging against this particular machine because he's a beloved man, it's a beloved theory, and I think it really gives us a crutch that shouldn't be used.
Well, it was helping the environmental movement to be able to get people through to the idea that there's more than strip malls in your job and that, in fact, we may be connected to all of the species, that we have some sense of ourselves as life on this planet, and I don't think that would be harmful. What's your take?
No, I absolutely agree with this. I mean, we are certainly just natural creatures, but now we have technology that nothing else has had. So I hate this sense that humans are not part of the natural chain of being, but I do recognize that we do produce spaceships and we do pump carbon dioxide into the atmosphere far faster and far more vigorously than any volcano, than all the volcanoes that have ever been on the planet. It's that double-edged sword again. I think we really need to recognize the size of our footprint clunging through here. But secondly, we recognize we are on a dying planet and that either we die with it or we engineer our way through it.
So in the book, you have a little bit of a sneer for the Al Gores of this world and blast for certain kinds of back to pre-industrial life and environmentalists. Are you having a problem with some environmentalism?
Well, I have problems in the sense that people say that let's just take it back to the way it was. And if people are willing to give up the clothes that we have, the transportation, the communication, but most readily, if people are willing to see half of their babies die and die horribly from childhood diseases, if people are willing to see life expectancy go back to 35 years old and willing to see misery during that 35 years, yeah, let's go back to nature. So we're not going to do that. I think I'm a parent. Parents will just not let that happen. So let's be realists. We're not going to go back to nature. We need to contain the problems that we produce. We need to recognize what we're doing, but I think we need to be realists. And I don't think the environmental movement is being realistic about much of what it wants to do.
We've been talking with Peter Ward. He's the author of the new book, The Medea Hypothesis, and it's published by Princeton University Press. And I notice on the inside page there, it says that you were selected by a group of scientists at the National Academy to write this book. So I think that puts you well beyond the crank level and somebody with some new things that we all need to know about. Peter Ward, thank you so much for talking with us.
And thank you for great questioning.
All right. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Download this full interview anytime as a free MP3 from our website, ecoshock.org. This is a Radio EcoShock replay show. You've heard two interviews from Professor Tim Garrett on why civilization must crash or else. Those were in 2010. Then Dr. Peter Ward with his Medea Hypothesis, The Mad Drive of Blind Biology, from the October 16, 2009 Radio EcoShock show. I'll put links to these interviews in my show blog at ecoshock.info, published every Wednesday. That's ecoshock.info. Last week, we also ran a convincing interview about the high danger of Arctic methane with Dr. Peter Wadhams of Cambridge. That is part of a longer interview done by Nick Breeze. I mistakenly said the film was for AMIG, the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, but really it's a private venture by Nick Breeze, and we can expect to see more in a sort of feature film from him coming up. Follow up on Nick's work and more of his videos at envisionnation.co.uk. That's envisionnation.co.uk. Thank you so much, Nick. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening.